So here we now have the Ottomans as in complete control over this area. The Byzantine Empire has now fallen. The Eastern Empire has fallen completely and has been taken over by the Turks. And the Turks, of course, are still there to this day. The Ottoman Empire eventually spread right around here through North Africa, and it's only been in this last century that that Ottoman Empire has at all been reduced in form. I suppose whatever our knowledge is of Revelation, we know a little bit about chapter 16, which spoke about the drying up of the Euphrates. Well, we're looking at the beginning of the story tonight. We're looking at the time when this new power was just formed on the other side of the Euphrates, preparatory to invading over here. Well, I can hear some of the tape recorders clicking, so we'll just stop there for a moment. Okay. Well, then, just as we were concluding with this particular map here, we were pointing out that we're now looking at the beginning of this period of this empire, which started from the other side of the Euphrates. It became eventually the Ottoman Empire, and that Ottoman Empire has continued right down. Well, it's not true to say that it still exists today, but the remnants of it exist today. And it was the Ottoman Empire which was down here in Palestine when General Allenby drove the Turk out of Palestine in, what, 1917 or something? And eventually, the area which we know today as Turkey is all that's left of the Ottoman Sultanate. But it is, in fact, the remnants of that particular power. I'm trying to give you just enough history to make it relevant without giving you too much to bore you. This, of course, won't satisfy everybody completely, but I'm trying to keep a middle range. And I think if we look at page 108 of our notes, we've got what I reckon is about the most adequate summary which covers the two extremes. It's not too much and it's not too little. And it's also, I think, interesting. Now, this is entitled The Historical Background of the Period of this Sixth Trumpet. The Turkomans, or Turks, were converts to Mohammedanism, so that when in the year 1055, Togrul Beg, commanding the Seljuks, that's the first group of these Turks, marched on Baghdad. Now, if you cast your mind back to the last class, we ended on the note of the fall of the power of the Caliph of Baghdad. Right? Now, here we've got the Turk coming into Baghdad, which was the seat of the Caliphates. Now, the Caliphate, that was where the Caliph of Baghdad lived, and he was their ruler there. The city surrendered without a struggle, and the Caliph gave the title of Sultan and temporal control over his domains to the Seljuk chieftain, while he himself retained religious control. So what he did was, he gave the title of Sultan, to which means sovereign, gave this title of sovereign. You might like to write that down somewhere if you haven't already done so. The word Sultan means sovereign. The Caliph gave the title of sovereign to this Turkish invader, while he himself retained religious control. So you had the Caliph left with religious power, and the Sultan who had the sovereign power. Meanwhile, other Turkish warriors had been raiding Byzantine territories, and eventually, led by Togrul's successor Alp Arslan, the Turkish army confronted the armies of the Emperor Romanus IV, or Diogenes, at Manzikert in August 1071 AD. In a battle of far-reaching consequences, the Asiatic provinces of the empire were irretrievably lost, and the emperor himself was taken prisoner. However, he was treated leniently by Alp Arslan and eventually released on easy terms. After Alp Arslan's assassination, he was succeeded by his son Malik Shah, who reigned for 20 years and was the first Turk to appropriate to himself the title Commander of the Faithful. In 1092, after the death of Malik Shah, civil war divided the empire into four: the Persian, Syrian, Kerman and Rum dynasties. The capital of this latter dynasty was Bithynia, only 100 miles from Constantinople, which was still seen as the vital key to papal dominion over Eastern Europe, Russia and the Near East. And then it goes on to speak about some of these other groups that arose. In 1096, a disorganized rabble of crusaders, now this is also the period of the Crusades, a disorganized rabble of crusaders led by Peter the Hermit set out to liberate the Holy Land from the hands of the Turks. But they only reached as far as Anatolia, the area of Turkey today, before they were killed off by the Turks. Eventually, Jerusalem was recovered by an army of Latin Christians, and the Turks were driven back beyond Antioch. Then at the beginning of the 13th century, a new power arose in Central Asia in the area of Mongolia. Now, this is the second group. This was a Mongol chieftain named Temujin, who contrived a plan to fuse his warring nomad tribes into an invincible army and set about the conquest of the world. In anticipation of this latter objective, he took the title of Genghis Khan, or Genghis Khan as some pronounce it, which means Lord of the Earth. Death came before he could fully realise his ambition, but his sons carried on his policy, and between 1234 and 1241 they invaded Russia, Poland and Hungary, and their incomparable pagan armies posed a threat to Christendom and Islam alike. By 1243 the Seljuk Turks had been defeated and forced into vassaldom, and the Abbasid Caliphate was savagely destroyed altogether in 1258, an event which rocked the Muslim world. With the Battle of Goliath Spring in 1260, the Mongol expansion halted for a time. Included actually in that comment about the Muslims, the Mongols, was also the Tatars, which I didn't mention in that particular section there. Now a new power had built up in northwestern Anatolia, ready to break into Europe. This was the Ottoman power. Although initially subjects of the Seljuk Empire, the Ottoman Turks had won their independence as the Seljuk Empire disintegrated under the impact of the Mongol invasions. In 1301 they gained their first victory over the Byzantines, in 1356 they crossed the Dardanelles and invaded Europe, and in 1397, with Constantinople almost all that was left of the Byzantines, the Ottomans surrounded the city and demanded its surrender. However, the city was saved by the advance of the Mongols under Tamerlane, who met and defeated the Ottoman forces in Ankara in July of 1402. In 1422, the Turks were again at the walls of Constantinople, and this time the city was only saved by revolt in Anatolia, which drew away the Turkish forces. In 1453, however, under Muhammad II, Constantinople was captured after a siege which lasted 40 days. Firearms, both muskets and cannons, were used in this battle, and from that day when it fell into the hands of the Ottoman Empire, Constantinople remained the Turkish capital. Now, this becomes very significant when we go back now to our Bibles and we read verse 15. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year for to slay the third part of the men. So that these four angel powers of the Euphratian region of the globe were loosed for the execution of a mission which was to be completed in a specific period of time. Now that specific period of time was covered by those notes which we've just read. This specific period is described as an hour, a day, a month and a year. Now at this stage we put back that other transparency which I told you I'd put back later. And I hope you can all read as much of that as you can. We were going to try and avoid that cord tonight, but we seem to have got it again. Anyway, I'll read what the note says. Some of you were previously copying down verse 14. You can go ahead and finish that off if you haven't already done so. But I've tried to set out here on this chart, very similarly to what we've done in the notes, the significance of this period, an hour, a day, a month and a year. Now, it works on exactly the same basis as that time period which we saw last time, which was the period of 150 days, or 150 years. It works on the basis of a day for a year. Now, how many days in a year? Answer, 360. There's 360 days in the Jewish year. So if there's 360 days in the year, then a year is 360 days, or on the basis of a day for a year, it becomes 360 years. All right, a day for a year, 360 days in a normal year, therefore on a day for a year basis it becomes 360 years, which is what we've got down there. And this is the same chart as on the bottom of page 107 of our notes. Well, a month is the 12th part of a year. 12 months in the year, right? So 12 into 360 goes 30. So a month is going to be 30 day years, that is 30 years. A day, well, a day is the 30th part of a month. Therefore, if one month represents 30 years, one day represents 1 year.
which of course we're going to come at much easier by simply saying that we're talking on a day for a year basis, therefore one day equals one year, but we came at it from both angles. And an hour is the 12th part of a day, and therefore it is 30 days, because there's 360 days in a year, and 12 into 360 goes 30. Now, if you didn't get it, sort of sit down and just say, well, it's all on a day for a year basis, and there's 360 days in a year, there's 30 days in a month, and you'll get it. Oh, and 12 hours in a day, you've got to remember that, not 24. So if you add all those up, an hour, a day, a month, and a year, you get 30 days plus a year plus 30 years plus 360 years. And that gives us 391 years and 30 days. Now, that represents that period that we've just been reading about. It represents a period dating from April the 27th, 1062, to May the 29th, 1453. Now, on April the 27th, 1062, was the wedding anniversary of Togrul Beg, when he married, I think he married the Caliph's daughter. I'm sure our notes cover this in just a moment. Yes. This period was the time appointed of the Spirit for the work of killing the third of the men, and dates from April the 27th, 1062, when Togrul Beg, being married to the daughter of the Caliph of Baghdad, became the head of the Mohammedan faith. The Caliph had very kindly given him the title of Sultan a few years earlier, but he wasn't satisfied with that, so he married the Caliph's daughter and he became head of the Mohammedan faith. And it ends on May the 29th, 1453, when Constantinople fell to Muhammad II, and that was the end of the Byzantine Empire. So the beginning of the work of these angels was when Togrul Beg became Sultan and also the head of the Mohammedan faith, down to the time when the Mohammedans finally overthrew the Eastern Empire. And it goes therefore from April the 27th to May the 29th, 1453. And that's as close as one can get to 391 years and 30 days. Now, we are told in that verse that they were to slay the third of the men. And this, of course, is what we've been looking at previously. The third that we are looking at now is the eastern third of the Roman Empire, known as the Byzantine Empire. And this remained Catholic until 1453, which was when the Muslims came in, or the Mohammedans came in, the Turks came in and overthrew the city of Constantinople. Now, I don't know how much of the details of that history you could remember, but I think basically, if you were to come back in a few weeks' time and say, well, I can remember this much, I can remember that the four angels here represent four successive divisions of the Turkish Empire, and you may remember that they're called Seljuks, Mongols, Tatars, and Ottomans, or you may not, but if you've got them in your margin, you will anyway. And the fact is that the period goes from the rise of these Turks, particularly the work of Togrul Beg, to the end of the Byzantine Empire, when Constantinople fell in the year 1453. Now we'll press on with our notes. Tell me when I have to stop. Just put your hand up as soon as I've gone too far, or nearly gone too far. Can we take it right off? Oops, all right, okay. Because we can slip another one up here underneath that. Well, we're coming on now to verse 16, must be. That's right, verse 16. Now, verse 16 says, "And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000 thousands, and I heard the number of them." This is one of these great numbers, representing a sort of a numberless multitude. A thousand thousands is a myriad. A myriad is... No. Huh? A myriad is 10,000. That's right. Let's read it again. "And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000 thousands, and I heard the number of them." Brother Thomas translates it, "It was two myriads of myriads." Now, a myriad is 10,000, therefore two myriads of myriads is 2 times 10,000 times 10,000, which equals 200 million.
This is the symbolical number of the four angel powers of cavalry. The number is not to be taken literally, but to indicate a large unnumbered multitude. The number of horsemen used by the Turks, whose soldiers were nearly all horsemen, during 400 years would not be likely to run far short of the immense figures of this trumpet. And so it was cavalry that was particularly involved. It's not so much the fact that we must say that every time we read horses in the Bible that it means cavalry. Of course, horses symbolise warfare and armies. But of course, in this particular case, it was significant that they did use cavalry in a very unique way for that period. So our note simply says, innumerable cavalry was the great feature of the Turkish operations. We go on then to verse 17. Finished with that one? Anyone not finished with that one? You're not finished with it. Alright, I'll just try and balance it there without it falling off. Now, verse 17 says that their breastplates were, and this is slightly different, this translation that Brother Thomas has, I saw the horses in the visions and those who sat upon them having breasts fiery and hyacinthine and sulphurous. The Authorised Version says, and I saw the horses in the vision and them that sat on them having breastplates of fire, of jacinth and of brimstone. He says of fire, or they were fiery, hyacinthine and sulphurous. Well, we know what fiery means. It means there was fire there. Hyacinthine or jacinth has relationship to the colour of blue, and there was this blue smoke, this blue flame, and sulphurous of course indicates the smell. Now all of these things have relationship to the rather unique type of warfare that the Turks engaged in. And our note here says that the Turks were the first to use cannon, and the description of the fiery bluish smoke of igniting gunpowder is most graphic in this particular verse. Now, okay, that mightn't seem very marvellous to us because we're quite familiar with it, but to people who'd never used this before, it's quite amazing the way in which the apocalypse here indicates the new aspect of warfare which was going to be used, and particularly in the invasion on Constantinople. It was the reason for their success. So we've got here then that the whole Turkish cavalry, or the whole Turkish career during centuries, is condensed into one immense army of cavalry which John sees and hears enumerated. The means by which this army prevailed to the extinction of Eastern Rome are illustrated. It is gunpowder. The Turks prevailed over the Romans by the use of gunpowder at a time when it had been recently invented. The Turks were the first to use cannons. It was by this they killed the third. The principal thing that would strike anyone witnessing an army of cavalry using field guns would be the three things mentioned by John: fire, smoke, and of course the brimstone or the smell of sulphur. And a description of the new weapons dragged after the horses at a time when they had no name would be a tale with a head to it, in which lay the power to hurt. And that's what the verse goes on to say, that it goes on to say that the heads of the horses were the heads of lion, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone. So we can go on and we can take the rest of the note on that particular sheet now. The heads of the horses, we are told, were as of lions. The roar of the guns was like the roaring of a lion. It was by these three things that the men were slain. Now, you take the three of the things by themselves. Fire, smoke and sulphur are sort of harmless enough in themselves. But when they are combined in a state of combustion, they are vividly descriptive of the use of artillery in warfare. So when you put these three things together, this is exactly what you would get in the case of exploding gunpowder. You get the fire, you get the bluish smoke, and you get the sulphurous smell described as brimstone. The power was in their mouth and in their tails. A battery going into action is at the tails of the horses. When in action, the guns have been swung around so that the tails become the heads, and from the mouths of which projectiles issue with fire, smoke and sulphurous smell.
the analogy of a striking serpent is very apt. So what we've got here in these verses is a description of the cannons being hauled into battle by the horses wheeling around, and out of the tails of the horses, not the literal tail, but of course the cannons which were at their tails, this fire and smoke and brimstone issued forth. So reading this section here from Brother Thomas's translation, we read that by these three were killed the third of men, by the fire and by the smoke and by the sulphur bursting forth out of their mouths, for their powers are in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails are like serpents having heads, and with these they do injure. And so it uses the aspect of the serpent as a similar analogy. Now you might like to read up the section in Eureka which tells you quite a bit about the gunpowder and all that sort of thing, but time's not going to permit us to go into that in any great detail this evening. Well, this brings us down now to the concluding verses of the chapter. Then we went to stop. Right, go back a little bit. Well, there's the remainder of the notes. Which will take us down to the end of the chapter. Now, verse 20 then goes on to say, "And the rest of the men who were not killed by these plagues changed not from the works of their hands, that they might not worship the demonials and idols of gold and silver, and of brass and of stone and of wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk, and changed not from their murders, nor from their sorceries, nor from their fornication, nor from their thefts." I can't conveniently put up this map at the moment because you're copying down this other thing, but if you were to if you were to see some of these maps which I've got here that we put up before, you'll see that the Western Roman Empire was still effective in small degree around the area of Italy. Whilst the empire as a power, as a political power, had fallen, as a religious system, we know full well that the power of the papacy still continued on in the West. So what these two verses are saying in simple form is this, that whilst the Byzantine Empire was overthrown and the Turks came in and took it over, the rest of the people back in Europe who were worshipping the idols and all that, they didn't learn the lesson. And their judgments were going to come in the pouring out ultimately of the vials. So whereas the seals were God's judgments on pagan Rome, the trumpets, which are now coming to a conclusion, were God's judgments on the Catholic Rome, on Western and Eastern together. And finally, the rest of the men who worshipped the idols and so forth were to be judged by the seven vials, which will come along a little later. Our note, in simple terms over here, says that the rest of the men refers to the Latin nations of Europe not included in the territory of the Ottoman Empire. These surviving Catholics still continued their apostate ways. It speaks about them still being addicted to their idols of gold and silver, while the worship of saints and images continued unabated in the Catholic West. It speaks about their murders, their sorceries, their fornications and their thefts. It's a description of the Roman system still extant and to be destroyed at the coming of Christ. That's a very brief description of something which you can read in slightly more detail in our notes and in greater detail in Eureka. While some of you are perhaps still copying that down, I will just take the opportunity then to read what our notes say. This refers to the Latin nations of Europe not included in the Ottoman Empire or the fourth Euphratian angel dominion. These still continued their worship of demons and idols, notwithstanding the overthrow of their image-worshipping brethren in the East. Notwithstanding the terrible affliction and overthrow of Eastern Rome by the Turks, as the instruments of God's vengeance, the populations of Western Europe continued addicted to the doctrines and practices of the Mother Church, which God has stamped with his execration. The Eastern section of Christendom was given over to the desolating Turk,
because of its long-standing and patiently borne but increasing abominations after the example of the seven nations of Canaan, who for a similar reason were given over to the sword of Joshua. The horsemen of the sixth trumpet, summoned by the trumpet blast of divine providence, swept over the third to its extermination and the consequent desolation of the lands over which they threw the blighting shadow of their subsequently established government. Which brings us to the end of Revelation chapter 9. There is just one interesting little historical feature which I think we ought to just look at briefly, and that is the final battle, which was the fall of Constantinople. What you need to get access to be able to understand what I'm going to say in the next few minutes, is a map of Constantinople. I'm going to project one up on the screen in just a minute, and I'm going to read you a little note here which describes the fall of Constantinople. The map that I'm going to put up can be found in that book called The Rise of Islam on page 25, but in a slightly more orthodox publication you'll find in the current Logos there is an interesting map of Constantinople on page 251 of the May 1976 volume 42 number 8. Quite a good little map of Constantinople there. It comes under the description of the Logos Tour of Bible Lands. So anybody either viewing or listening should be able to get access to that map. And you'll see on there the old city walls and things like that, which were part of the story of the fall of the city of Constantinople. Now, because you can't see that at the moment, I'll put this other map up. Looks like you're still copying this down, are you? All right, I'll put it up in just a minute. I'll find the page on here that I'm going to read, and then when I get to that, we'll put the map up. Can I take that one off? No. Can't take that one. Did anyone not want that one taken? Only one person. Well, that... played the organ too. Right. Any other little jobs? Someone lose a white button? Wasn't that white peppermint? Start again, slowly.
There's also several maps too. On the apocalypse.
Oh.
I believe
I've seen that too. Oh, I'll have a look at that in just a moment. I haven't seen that before. Arthur's just given me a chart you can stick in your Bible. Can I stick that in mine? Oh. All right. Well, looks orthodox too, doesn't it? Can we put this up now? Oh, well, I think I can squeeze it up underneath there. Now, not quite sure how good that map's going to be. That's not bad. This is the area of Constantinople here. Here's the city. It's like a sort of a triangle, like this. And this is the ancient city walls across here. And the description of the taking of the city is quite interesting. We're told that during the spring of 1452, Muhammad II built another fort called Rumali Hisar, I think it's called, which was right up there. Constantinople down here on the European slopes of the Bosphorus, where it still stands. Seen that one? Is it? You've seen that fort, have you? Oh. Hope this book's right then. The Ottomans thus commanded the Bosphorus. That's the straits of the Bosphorus there then, Arnold, right? Getting up towards the top there, they come up there. You know, Gallipoli and all that had something to do with this, didn't it? That's down the other end. Anzac Day. The Ottomans thus commanded the Bosphorus. Beyond the massive fortified walls on the western land side of the city, Muhammad was known to be massing his troops in Thrace. He was said to have at least 150,000 men between the Sea of Marmara and the Golden Horn. There's the Golden Horn there.
Where's the Sea of Marmara? Around the bottom there. Right. So he's got to get into this city here. There's St. Sophia's. That's the big, what was a basilica, church, cathedral, and now is a Turkish mosque. And that was the emperor's palace there. And he had to either get in by sea, but they'd laid a chain across there, so they couldn't get past that, or else he had to come through these walls here.
We'll wait and see what he did. He was said to have at least 150,000 men between the Sea of Marmara and the Golden Horn, including the famous regular soldiers, the Janissaries, as well as many irregulars called Bashi Bazooks, and innumerable hangers-on out for plunder. That's probably where they get bazooka from, it's the same word. His artillery included enormous cannons. The largest needed 60 oxen to drag it up to the walls of Constantinople, and 200 men to keep it in place on its wagon. So, you know, we say, oh, with gunpowder and guns, but you're making a big thing out of nothing. You imagine something even that size today. And here was virtually the introduction. Oh, mind you, it had been around the place a bit, I suppose, but here was a city being invaded with a cannon that required 200 men to keep it on its place, on its wagon. By early April 1453, the Turkish army was outside the land walls. The Byzantines had refused an offer to spare their city if it surrendered. They shut their land gates. That's the gates going across, the gates in that wall going across there. They shut their land gates on April the 2nd and broke down the bridges over the 60-foot wide foss or ditch. The fortifications were arranged in three lines. The inner wall was approximately 40 feet high with lofty towers at intervals. A second or outer wall with towers ran parallel to it. And the third wall was a kind of crenellated breastwork which formed the inner wall of the foss. These fortifications were entered through gates placed at intervals. Halfway along the wall, the ground dipped, forming the little valley of the River Lycus. And the River Lycus is... it's not there, but it actually came up through there, through the wall, and dipped down through that particular section there. It was here in this valley that the Ottomans concentrated their attack. And so that there says it's the Sultan's tent. Oh, actually, that blue line is the river. Sorry, I was being unfair to the drawer. That's the river there, and he planted his tent right there by that river. The besieged were estimated by Sfrantzes, the emperor's secretary, as numbering 6,983 men, including 2,000 foreigners, mainly Venetians and Genoese. He goes on to say some of the people that were there. Turkish troops took up their place before the land walls with their heavy artillery. The Sultan's brilliantly coloured tent was pitched opposite the Lycus Valley sector of the front, while the Turkish fleet in the Bosphorus and the Sea of Marmara tried to cut off supplies and to force their way across the boom into the Golden Horn. They were going to try and get across that chain there into this area known here as the Golden Horn, but they had some problems. From 12th of April onwards, the Turkish guns bombarded the city walls and the Turkish soldiers tried to fill in the foss. Great gaps were made in the outer wall, which the Christians, in inverted commas, were defending. On the 20th of April, four Genoese ships dodged through the Turkish fleet and reached the Golden Horn behind the boom. This defeat stirred up Muhammad to renew his attempts to gain the possession of the Golden Horn. His engineers now contrived to bring ships overland from the Bosphorus into the Golden Horn. They were fixed on wheeled cradles and dragged over rollers by oxen. So what they did is they had their fleet out here, and so they brought them across the land there. They didn't have to worry about getting across this chain. They brought them across the land and into the Golden Horn there. They were fixed on these cradles and dragged over rollers by oxen, to the dismay of the Christians. And on the 22nd of April, about 70 Turkish ships made their appearance in the Golden Horn. The struggle dragged on for another month. Within the city, Greeks, Genoese and Venetians quarrelled. Food and ammunition were short. A ship which got through on the 23rd of May reported that no Venetian rescue fleet could be seen in the Aegean. Meanwhile, Muhammad keyed up his forces for a final general assault planned for the 29th of May, promising 3 days unrestricted looting. Then on the 28th of May, there was silence in the Turkish camp and its soldiers rested and fasted before the assault. Inside the city, Muhammad's intentions were realised. During the days of the 25th to the 27th of May, there had been bad omens. The picture of the Mother of God had fallen to the ground as it was being carried in procession around the city. This was followed by a thunderstorm and a cloudburst and a dark fog, and strange lights were seen playing over St. Sophia, the Cathedral of the Holy Wisdom. The emperor was advised to leave the city, which God had abandoned. That would be one historical error. I think God had abandoned it long before that particular point of time. But he refused. On the evening before the attack, all Greek and Latin alike went to the cathedral, and there they celebrated the last Christian liturgy to be held in the great church. Then each man went to his post on the outer wall. About an hour after midnight, the attack began. First the Bashi Bazooks and the Anatolian Turks, and finally the Janissaries. At the crucial moment, the Genoese leader Giustiniani was wounded and carried through the inner wall into the city to a Genoese ship in the harbour. Amidst the dismay this caused, Mahomet spurred on his Janissaries, who succeeded at last in breaking the stockade at the outer wall and gaining access to the city through the inner wall. Other Turks had made their way through a small postern gate to the north and had raised the Turkish standard. The cry went up, "The city is taken." The Turkish entry was followed by a panic among the Christians. And it goes on to say in some more detail there about the way in which Christianity had come to an end. It says, "It was a humiliating fate for an empire convinced of its universal mission. But Byzantium had served Christendom well. It had kept the Arabs out of much of Europe. It had taught the young Slav nations their statecraft, and it had brought them Christianity. It had given the world its own creative medieval art and its Greek heritage of literature and science." Now, there's all sorts of other little details that you might like to read in whatever books you can come across. But what I was trying to bring out there was not so much necessarily the way in which it was taken, but the way in which these writers see this as being distinctly the end of an epoch. So that when you turn up the notes, or you turn up Eureka, and you read there that this particular date of May the, what was it, May the 29th, 1453 is an important date, and you say, "Oh, well, look, I think all he's done is he's taken 391 years and 30 days, he's added it to that period of 1062, and that's the answer he's come up with. It happened to be some sort of battle in which Constantinople fell, so what?" Well, it's not quite like that at all, because it was obviously a most significant battle. You know, there were all the omens in St. Sophia and all these sort of things. Christianity in that part of the world came to an end. And with it, we see the conclusion, therefore, of these judgments of the six trumpets found in Revelation chapters 8 and 9. So that, in fact, brings us to the end of that particular section. God willing, in the next Revelation study that we do, we'll be looking at chapter 10, where the theme apparently changes, but it's not really. It's showing us the climax of all of these judgments. So our four wind trumpets, God's judgments on Western Rome, and now our first two woes, God's judgments on Eastern Rome, show to us that down through the ages, in response to the prayers of the saints, God will manifest his glory in the earth in whatever way he feels so disposed to do, in whatever generation it happens to be. We are most privileged, of course, to be on the eve of witnessing the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. Let us be sure that as a result of our studies in this particular subject, that we see more than just interesting historical facts, and that we indeed, like the saints of all ages, desire the return of Christ more than anything else in life.
Brothers and sisters, we'll conclude our meeting this evening by singing hymn 192, followed by prayer. Hymn 192.